WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You may remember Charlie Bird's 1962 collaboration with Stan Getz, an album that was critically and commercially successful. The record was called Jazz Samba. The album helped start the bossa nova craze in the States. Charlie Bird has kept mostly to acoustic guitar. He's studied classical guitar and spent time studying with Andre Segovia. He's made many records. Some of his recent ones are on the Concord Jazz record label. Charlie Bird has come to the Delaware Valley to perform tonight, Saturday, and Sunday night at the Flight Deck, which is the jazz club located in the terminal of the Greater Wilmington Airport. Now, that's on the DuPont Highway. If you'd like to call there about the concert, here's the phone number. It's area code 302-328-0444. Again, that's area code 302-328-0444. Charlie Bird, what a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you about how you started to play guitar in the first place. I've read that your father was a guitarist. I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
I think that had a lot to do with it. My father and his friends were amateur players, and they just played for fun. And it looked like fun to me from the time I can remember anything. My first memories are listening to my father play and standing by him while he played and crying because he wouldn't let me. And I'm sure that was the most important aspect of it.
Many is the young person who thought that making music seemed like a lot of fun, it looked like fun, so they tried to learn an instrument, only to find that their musician friends or the musician adults around them would discourage them and say, it's a really hard life. Don't want to do it.
I'm talking about 3 or 4 years old. You don't get disillusioned like that at that age.
Uh-huh.
And I finally started playing when I was about 8. And I think that one of the great advantages in starting to play very young is that you haven't built up this set of criteria for great things that you like. You know, if you're 18 and you're aware of Segovia and John Williams and whoever else you might like, jazz players or rock players, it can be pretty discouraging. But when you're 8, whatever results you get are kind of very much fun.
I guess a grim note for people who start when they're 18.
Well, no, it's not grim. It's just it's something they should be aware of. They have to use a religious phrase, they have to come to music like a child.
When did you start studying classical guitar? What were your interests when you were young and you were starting to play? What direction were you heading in?
I started, the first things I did musically were the things that my father did, and he was, they didn't have terms like bluegrass and those terms didn't exist, but I mean, some of the music we played was like that because it was all acoustical stringed instruments. And he played the mandolin as well, and I did too. I learned the mandolin at the same time I did the guitar. But we also played Italian tunes. He knew a lot of jazz tunes, and whatever he thought he could get away with, that's what he played, and I still do that. Also, it was a very black part of the country, and my father owned the store, and I heard a lot of black blues players. So that was part of my early training as well.
You studied for a while with Andre Segovia. Can you talk with us a little bit about where for you classical technique and theory and jazz playing meet and help one another?
My own interest in classical music came as a listener. You know, as I got a little older, my taste and what I wanted to hear became more sophisticated, and I had a roommate in the VPI when I was going there who was he had lived in Europe a lot and he liked classical music, and his mother used to come there and take him to concerts, and I would go along with him, and I got very much interested in listening to classical music. And it was several more years before I discovered, I wasn't even aware that there was such a thing as a repertoire for the classical guitar. And when I finally discovered that amazing fact, I said, well, this is something I should know something about. I think studying the classical guitar is very much like studying the classical drama if you're an actor. I mean, this is where the best record of the development of the art is to be found. You know, whether or not you are going to end up a Shakespearean actor or not, you aren't going to get broad and great experience doing situation comedy on television, for instance. You know, the development art of the art over hundreds of years is to be found in its classical literature, and I firmly believe that's the most rewarding place to look to study, and that's been my experience. I can't quarrel with the fact that there are a lot of wonderful players who could care less about that. But for me, it was very enlightening, and it sustained my interest, and I'm still very much interested in learning, and I think that's one of the great sources for learning.
Just to ask you a question about the comparison that you just made, you don't consider jazz to be the musical comedy of music, do you?
Well, jazz occupies a funny position.
I don't mean the musical comedy. I mean the sitcom is what I mean.
I don't mean that at all, but I just mean that what I mean is, as far as studying jazz is concerned, the documentation isn't there, you know. It isn't there in the pedagogy, and it isn't there in anything else. You have to get out and listen. You have to experience. Jazz is a very individual music. Other musics are too. But what I'm saying is, from the standpoint of a student, the scope of classical music is so much larger. You know, it takes in so much more. I'm not belittling jazz in any means. I like jazz. I still play it, and I hope to always play jazz. As a matter of fact, I play more of that than anything else. But I'm saying, from the standpoint of studying music, the well for me is the classical music.
I guess that explains in part why you have kept mostly to the acoustic guitar. It seems, thinking quickly, that there are few jazz musicians who have not really learned the electric guitar, and I don't necessarily mean an electric guitar that has a lot of effects wired into it.
Well, just to be heard.
An amplified
just
guitar,
to be heard.
As opposed to being amplified by a microphone next to the acoustic guitar, which will give a different sound than if you have an amp on the guitar
itself.
Well,
the electronics has improved, you know, so that now you can play classical guitar and in conjunction with more instruments than you could. It's very understandable why most people play jazz on the electric guitar, because most of the instruments that are used in jazz are too loud to be played with the acoustic guitar. You have to be very picky and choosy and be very careful how you play things if you're going to blend with other instruments. I mean, of course, if you're playing solo, it doesn't matter. But, it is confining in who you can play with.
Charlie Bird, you really had a lot to do with what developed into the bossa nova craze in the 1960s here in America. From what I know, I guess it dates back to a tour that you took of South America in the early 60s. Can you tell us about that, about your first exposure to Latin American music?
Well, that was a matter of being at the right place at the right time. I had that tour took place about 14, 15 years after I had become interested in the classical guitar. And I had some prior experience with Latin American classical composers, Villa-Lobos and some others that wrote music in a more or less popular South American vein. I had also played with some Cuban bands when I was playing in New York, because, you know, when Charlie Parker was playing with Manteco and things like that, there was a certain interest in a fusion of jazz and Latin music. And I spent a little bit of time with Catherine Dunham, the great dancer, and was exposed to Latin American music through her, so that when I arrived on this tour, I had a few things going for me. First of all, I played the guitar with my hands from classical study, which is the way the Brazilians all play. And secondly, I was moderately acquainted with the music.
You say with your hands, you mean as opposed to a pick?
Yes. So it was a matter of being at the right place at the right time and at least partially equipped to take advantage of the situation.
How did you decide when you came back to the States to start working that stuff into the music that you were playing and recording?
Well, we started before we came back. There was one other factor, too, that made the bossa nova a rather easy thing, because this was music in Brazil. It was developed by people who were very interested in American music, primarily jazz, and also American songwriters. Joe Beam was very well aware of the great American songwriters. And so the amalgamation had already been made by the Brazilians, you know, so that was another thing going in my favor.
American pop culture certainly seemed ready for this and picked up on it all with hundreds of bossa nova tunes. I even remember Edie Gourmet's recording of Blame It on the Bossa Nova.
Yeah. Well, it got to be a fad with bossa nova neckties and stuff. And
right.
All of that was almost unfortunate. I don't think that changed the fact that Joe Beam is probably the best songwriter in the second half of this century, no matter who you throw in. Maybe give or take a Michel Legrand or somebody like that or two. I think Joe Beam is head and shoulders above anything else that's come out, and I think there are enough people around that recognize that. I think one of the things that made it short-lived was that the people who promoted it were overzealous in their promotions, and they got into this, the dance studios developed these jive dances to go with it, which never came from Brazil. They developed all this, the name bossa nova and all kind of things that they usually do with commercial things. I think that the music might have sustained even better than it did if they would have never gotten into all that. But, you know, that's my own feeling.
So a lot of people wanted to cash in on it, recording artists, record companies,
oh, of course,
dance people.
Well, if they don't cash in, nothing's going to happen with it. I can understand that. But I think anything that had as much quality to it didn't necessarily need to be gimmicked as much as it was.
How much is samba and bossa nova a part of your playing now?
Oh, a good part. I think it always will be. I don't make any attempt to stay au courant, if that's the way you pronounce that. I play what I like to play, and I still play a lot of the old bossa nova tunes in rotation, because I recorded over 100 of them, I guess, at one time or another. And if a new one comes out, I jump on that as well.
Let's hear one of the ones that you recorded. We're going to hear the one-note samba from an album called Charlie Bird Latin Impressions. And do you want to say a few words about this recording?
Well, this is the first recording. This is the recording we did of this tune when we got back from South America, which we learned by ear. As a matter of fact, the bridge on it's wrong, because I learned the tune from my drummer, who stayed up all night jamming with some Brazilian musicians, and we got the melody starting on the wrong pitch. But this bridge works all right too. So
okay, well, let's hear it. My guest Charlie Bird featured on guitar.
Thank you.
guitarist Charlie Bird, the one-note samba. Charlie Bird is joining me in the studio now. He's in the Delaware Valley to play tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday night at the Flight Deck, which is the jazz club at the Greater Wilmington Airport. You have been on all ends of jazz clubs, Charlie Bird. You, from 1956 to 66, own a jazz club in Washington, D.C. called the Showboat, and you've played in clubs probably around the world. What makes a good club? What makes a good place to play?
Well, I think that the easiest way to say that would be it takes some loving care on the part of the owner. I don't think there is such a thing as a successful jazz club, except that it's owned by someone who really cares about the music. You know, if a guy's looking for a place to make a lot of money, looking for a place to meet girls, or if he has any other motive other than loving the music and wanting to do something for it and, you know, form a team with the players and present them in the best possible light, then it's not going to make it.
Did you try to have an atmosphere created within the club that jived with the atmosphere you most like to play in as a musician?
Yes, I did. I mean, we had made the service conform to the music. You know, the waitresses didn't intrude on the music. Sometimes, in certain situations, service in parts of the room would be limited, so that. In other words, the music was the most important thing because that's what the people are coming for. It's not just a cocktail lounge. I think that club owners who try to open a jazz club and try to combine it with a regular cocktail lounge or a singles bar or something else have got a problem, because this offends the jazz fans. If you come into a club and all these other things are happening, it's a distraction. I know that's contrary to the earlier tradition of jazz clubs, when it was played in brothels and things like that, when the good times roll. But you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, I don't think any jazz club can function that way very long. I mean, part of why I need quiet is because I play an acoustical guitar, and what I play is necessarily quiet, but Dizzy Gillespie likes quiet, too. You know, he can knock the eardrums out if he wants to, but that isn't what he's looking for. He wants to be able to play with dynamics. He wants to be able to play very softly at some point without a party of drunks being louder than he is. You know, this is important to any musician.
Did you ever find that your desires as someone who plays music and loves music conflicted with your needs as the club owner? And I know you weren't in it to make a financial killing. On the other hand, nobody likes to lose money.
Well, you have
in a
to,
business
you have,
enterprise.
You have to make money, or it's going to last.
Well, I know a lot of times that the people who I would consider to be the most talented musicians are not the people who would draw the biggest crowds and who would keep a club financially in the running.
Well, you have to consider a lot of things. You have to running a club. I think any club that's trying to stay open full time has to do some experimenting with people that he likes, and you know, in combination with he thinks can be built into having a following. Sometimes it takes some patience on his part. You know, if you have someone come in, it might not do very well the first time, but if it's good, the word of mouth and the promotion can turn that act, if you want to use that term, into someone who can do business. Your question was, was it a conflict with me? And the answer is yes, it was. What I like is not necessarily always what's going to go well, and I made a lot of boo-boos that way. I think I learned a little something in the process. I learned to look a little more carefully at who the people were, who the clientele were that generally came to the club, and things like that. You know? Because everybody you know, there's no musician in the world that can't go somewhere where everyone says, who's he? You know, I mean, you could have the biggest, best-known rock star, a guy who can fill the Veterans Stadium, and he goes to another part of town in a club, and nobody knows who he is, you know. And that's the nature of the music business. So you have to know who your clientele are, and you have to know who you think can be successful, as well as who you like to hear.
Who do you like to hear now?
Who do I like to hear? I like to hear music. I listen to a lot of different kinds of music. I probably listen to more classical music. I listen to a lot of old things. Someone gave me recently a record of Fred Astaire that was done with Oscar Peterson.
Oh,
Ray
I play
Brown.
That on the show a lot. It's and, a wonderful record.
And it's, you know, I like it. Doesn't meet every criteria for a jazz record that I can think of, but it's a marvelous record. I like it a lot. The songs are so clear, and there's not a muddled word in the whole thing, and there's some damn good jazz playing on it, especially from Charlie Shavers. He sounds absolutely magnificent on that record. And, you know, that's an example of one record I've listened to a lot lately.
Guitarist Barney Kessel is featured on that record. I remember playing a track from it when he was on the show.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because you and Barney Kessel and Herb Ellis, from where I stand, seem to be pretty close with one another. I have before me, which we'll be hearing a selection from in a minute, an album in which you're all featured. You've recorded other albums with Herb Ellis. It seems that it could go either way when you are amongst a certain group of guitarists. You can be in really close competition with one another, or you can have a certain camaraderie that only that similar talent could develop. It seems to me that you must be pretty close. Could you talk a little bit about how you relate to one another musically and personally?
We have a great time off the stand. You know, we get along well. That's easy. I don't think any of us really believe in this competition. You know, I think that's for the football field. I mean, I think it's a bit juvenile to think in those terms if you're a musician. You know, if you're playing with someone whose musicianship is way beyond yours, you try to do the best you can to blend with them. If you play with someone who isn't quite up to you in the area that you happen to be playing, then you play with sympathy because you're trying to make it. You're trying to make music. I mean, competition. Even sometimes, what sounds like competition in a concert or something is not really competition. You know, I remember a story. A story that someone who was with the Jazz Philharmonic told that Norman Granz had a specialty at one point where he had Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich do kind of a challenge, a drum challenge, and it went on for a while, and everything went smooth. The audience liked it and everything, and on one occasion, Buddy Rich got the feeling that Gene Krupa was beginning to be serious, that he's really trying to cut me, you know, so evil man that Buddy Rich is supposed to be, he wasted him, you know, he pulled everything out that he could do, and that ended that, you know. But I mean, it's show business, you know, when you, it's one of the tricks to make it sound competitive, but who believes it, you know, because everybody realizes that musicians are individual people, you know, and any kind of competition would have to be, you'd have to draw up a set of rules, you know. Like Segovia doesn't play country as well as Roy Clark, for instance. So, you know, the whole idea of competition becomes ridiculous.
Well, let's hear a selection from the album that you recently recorded with Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel. It's an album on Concord Jazz called Great Guitar Straight Tracks. You had mentioned Fred Astaire a moment ago. Well, we'll be hearing a song that's associated with him. It's a tune by Irving Berlin that he sang. It's called I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket. And my guest Charlie Bird is, of course, featured on guitar on this. He takes the first guitar solo.
I also made this arrangement.
Great.
You chose that without my telling you, but I was pleased that you did, because we all do the arrangements, and this one is mine.
Oh, terrific. Well, let's hear it. Thank you. I'm putting all my eggs in one basket from an album called Great Guitars, featuring my guest Charlie Byrd along with two other great guitarists, Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel. And the arrangement on that recording was done by Charlie Byrd. He again is in Philadelphia now because he's going to be in Delaware performing tonight, Saturday night, and Sunday night at the Flight Deck, which is a jazz club right in the Greater Wilmington Airport. You don't, by the way, I know what you're thinking, you don't hear planes taking off as the person's playing.
That's pretty good.
It is. What kind of settings do you most like to be recorded in? You've recorded in a number of different kinds of settings, with strings, without strings, with other guitarists, with your own trio or quartet. What are your favorite ways to hear yourself on record?
I like all those ways. I think what I like to do with the guitar works best either solo or with trio. But I also like the stimulation of playing with other people. That's one of the great bits of fun about playing music, is the exchange of ideas and just the exchange of how you phrase something. It's fun. It's fun to play with other people. So I like all those ways.
You and the other two guitarists who we both heard from, Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel, have all, at some point in your careers, played in the bands of television shows.
Mm.
Have you done that recently?
No.
Oh, you did some of that in the 60s, I guess.
Yeah.
Is it an experience you look back on with pleasure or not?
I don't care for studio sort of work. It has advantages. Keeps you off the streets, and at one point it gave musicians a chance to live a more normal life than they ordinarily would.
Because there's a salary
and a place to stay, and you can have families and things like that. But the playing part's not very interesting.
Well, you were telling me you're on the road about 50% of the time.
Yes.
You're married. How do you keep it up? Is it a strain to be traveling that much?
I try to take my wife with me as much as I can. I would say that my wife and I are together about 90% of the time. Maybe 75, I don't know. But most of the time we're together. And that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. So what are your plans for the near future?
I have some one-nighters coming up, and 1st of October I go to Europe, and after that we're going to that's a month, and then most of November we'll be in Eastern Europe and possibly North Africa. That hasn't been fully set. Then I'll come back home for December, which I make it a point always to do that.
For Christmas?
For
the snow.
I don't like snow. I like snow in small doses, but you got to touch base somewhere. You know, all this traveling, so I just insist that I'm going to be home at that time of year, which is it's kind of fun because it's the time for getting together with friends and family and stuff like that. Just sort of renew yourself. Then after that, I'm going to head south and try to get away from the snow. I'm going to begin the year in Florida, and then have a long engagement in New Orleans, Phoenix.
A clever itinerary.
Sometimes it works out okay.
Charlie Byrd, I want to thank you for being here. I wish you the best in your travels.
Thank you.
Charlie Byrd is now here. Now he's going to be in Delaware for concerts tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday night at a club called the Flight Deck, which is at the Greater Wilmington Airport. And do you know what time the sets will be starting?
Yes, 9:30 and 11:30.
9:30 and 11:30 each of those nights. I'll give you a number to call if you'd like any more information or directions on how to get there. It's on the DuPont Highway. That phone number is 302, that's the area code, 328-0444, area code 302-328-0444. Charlie Byrd, thanks again so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure to have you here. We're going to listen to another selection from your new album on the Concord record label. The album's called Bluebird, and from it we're going to hear Rodgers and Hart's This Can't Be Love. Thank you. This Can't Be Love, guitarist Charlie Byrd.